Hi, and welcome back, everyone, to the Warwick Medical School Digital Technology Podcast. And we're really happy to have in the studio with us Dr. Greg Mortlock to talk us through some of the interesting issues in digital health ethics.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here.
Brilliant. Okay, well, before we get into the nitty-gritty of it, I think it'd be really interesting if our audience learned a little bit about your path into to the area of ethics.
Sure, we can delve back into the murky history of Mortlock, which is always troubling territory. So I started by doing a philosophy degree simply because I found it really interesting. I had no particular job aspirations. I was fortunate enough to choose a degree that was just something that I thought would be interesting for 3 years to study. Then at the end of that, I sort of had the philosopher's problem of what do I do now that I've got a philosophy degree and it hasn't led to any job. So I took the traditional philosopher's response to that and did a master's in ethics and political theory, which was simply because I'd found the ethical side of philosophy to be the most interesting. I've liked a lot of areas of philosophy, but the ones that always struck me as most relevant and most important were the ones that actually have practical applications. So whilst it's interesting to think about like pre-Socratic philosophy, in terms of real world usefulness, it's ethics for me. So that's what I enjoyed as an undergraduate. That's what I focused on at postgraduate. And then at the end of a master's, I realized I just sort of deferred the problem by an additional year and still didn't have a job or any clear sense of direction. So at that point, I very nearly became a primary school teacher.
That would have been a different set of problems for you.
I mean, classroom control, nothing too dissimilar to what I do now, I suppose.
Your CBL group, I guess, yeah.
But I was all set to start a PGCE and then saw an advert for a PhD position at Birmingham University and applied for that, thinking that I wouldn't get it, and then ultimately did get it. And that focused on the ethics of conditional organ donation. So that was really my first...
Okay, so that's getting you into the more medically applied ethics.
Yeah, that got me into medical ethics, which was a more sort of niche field compared to general philosophical ethics. But I found it really interesting. And since then, research-wise, I focused primarily on transplant ethics, organ donation ethics. Mm-hmm. But teaching-wise, teach all medical ethics now. A fairly sort of straightforward journey into it, but characterized by indecision and procrastination in terms of decision making.
Well, that's we're grateful that it's brought you to us at the medical school, and maybe we could reframe procrastination as in-depth reflection.
That's a nice way of looking at it. Yeah,
very good. Okay, so let's get into some of the content of today's episode. So we wanted to talk a little bit about understanding protected health information. So perhaps we could start with, you know, what would you interpret as protected health information?
So I suppose I come at this as a bit of a closet GDPR enthusiast. So I tend to frame things in the same sorts of ways that GDPR and British law thinks about things. So there is the broad category of personal data, which is sort of any sort of information that identifies people. And that obviously falls under things like the Data Protection Act. So that type of data has to be protected. Within that broad category of personal data, there are special categories of data, mm-hmm. and health data falls into that special category of data. Right. So it's considered to be particularly sensitive information about people's health and about treatment they may be receiving. All of that sort of broad package of information which relates to people's health is particularly sensitive. So there are particular additional protections that come into play in relation to that type of personal information. The key point being that it relates to identifiable individuals in a very clear way.
Okay, well, that's a clear definition. So that talks about protected health information in the general context. And why is that so specifically important in digital healthcare?
I suppose that some of the... Well, it's important information per se. In relation to digital healthcare, I think the risks associated with that type of information are perhaps more significant or amplified. Because if you imagine sort of non-digital health information just locked away in a filing cabinet, securely stored, accessed only very occasionally when it needs to be accessed, that's fairly straightforward data. That's going to be secure. That's unproblematic. But when it comes to things like digital healthcare and the use of digital things more generally, it's much more accessible. It may be accessed for different purposes, potentially. There's potentially greater benefit to yield from that type of data as well. And that introduces a whole new level of risk to that. So if you've got data locked in a filing cabinet and the room is locked, you can be fairly sure that that data is going to be secure. If you've got data stored on a computer somewhere, well, you need to make sure that computer is secure. It's also very easy to duplicate that data, stick it on another computer. Then you've created effectively twice the risk. So it's very easy for, within a digital context, for this type of very sensitive data to not be as well protected as you might hope that it would be.
Yeah, especially with all things like cloud backup and all the other forms of digital storage that we use so readily in our everyday lives. Okay, so if we move on to segment two, so we're talking about the managing of this kind of patient data. So medical students are increasingly exposed to all the digital systems during their placements, you know, the electronic health records, the hospital information systems. What are some of the best practices that they should adopt when handling digital patient data?
I think fundamentally a starting point is only access data that you are supposed to be accessing and only access it for the purposes you're supposed to be accessing it. So you will potentially have access to a vast array of personal data. But if you don't have permission to access that data, then you simply should not be doing so. And this can sometimes make life more difficult. So I think back to when I was doing research in a transplant clinic, because I'm not a member of medical staff in that clinic, I'm not allowed to look at patient records. So I had to ask for a clinician to actually filter patients and screen them for me so that I could recruit them into the research that I was doing. But the people in that clinic are very busy. They don't really have time to do that. So their default reaction was to just pass me a pile of paper-based patient records and tell me to do it myself.
Get on with it.
Yeah. But I couldn't do that, like, because it would just be wrong. It would be ethically wrong, but also unlawful for me to do that. And as a junior researcher, I wasn't prepared to put myself in that position. So I got swore at very loudly by by a very, very senior medical figure. But fundamentally, that was right for me to stand my ground on that and not breach the privacy of patients who have not consented to that.
Well, it would have been ironic to be doing that as part of ethical.
Yeah, you have to draw the line somewhere.
Okay, very good. So what have you found through your pastoral roles in the medical school as well as common mistakes that medical students and, you know, more broadly moving into junior medical staff, which I might add on, can make when working with the electronic health records and or even things like the messaging app?
I would say that the mistakes that people tend to make are in terms of duplicating information, creating copies of it, sometimes even creating paper-based copies of electronic records and not keeping those records secure. So just as examples of where things can sometimes go wrong, like memory sticks can get lost. So things like unencrypted memory sticks are a massive problem. Thankfully, they're not something that too many people tend to use these days. But in the past, a loss of a memory stick with patient data on can be a real problem. And if you respond to that in the way that you are supposed to respond to it, by reporting the fact that you have lost that memory stick, you can potentially find yourself and your employer in quite a lot of trouble, actually. So the implications of that can be really serious. Other things that people sometimes get wrong is thinking about ethics sessions in particular, when people are presenting cases about patients, they will present so much information that actually a patient becomes potentially identifiable when there is not necessarily any need for that to happen.
So talking about, you're just filling in the story a bit. You're saying, you know, patient from Coventry with perhaps, for example, a wheelchair user, something maybe visually identifiable. And just whilst you're intending only to, you know, to fill out the context, you're actually potentially allowing that to be de-anonymized.
Yeah, so this actually led to a really quite strange scenario for me, where I knew someone who had died of a fairly rare form of cancer. And during some of the GP block ethics sessions in phase three, various students over the course of about 6 months or so ended up presenting this patient's case. And because they gave particular information, such as the age of the patient, the type of cancer, the location, details about the research that they were participating in, it very clearly identified that patient to me. And I learned things about that patient that I didn't know prior to those discussions. So that was technically a breach of patient confidentiality, even though
being very unintentional, wasn't it?
Very unintentional. But it shows how easy it is. Like, you may think that you are giving truly anonymized information, but actually there may be someone who can add other stuff to that information, join up the dots, and work out exactly who you are talking about.
Very much so. And we'll touch back into that when we go and discuss the research component. And I suppose if I was going to share clinically from the junior doctor perspective some of the errors that I've seen unintentionally, a lot of the time people want to share and they take consent from the patient to take images on their mobile phones of things like rashes that the patient needs to leave before they've consulted with me as the senior supervising clinician. And they, you know, promise to delete it straight away. However, the phones often upload to cloud, and then even when you delete that information, it still exists and it'll still be discoverable later. And sometimes people unintentionally leave it on their phones, and you never know what's going to happen to your phone later. You recycle it or what have you. So there are a lot safer ways to share those images. At the moment, I suggest that they actually use the patient's own device, and we can actually use a encrypted text to the patient where they can upload the images themselves from their own device directly into their own electronic health record within the NHS health record system. So that's a more secure way that they can do it. So the GMC's Good Medical Practice document, which I'm sure our students and listeners are all very very familiar with, that outlines expectations for doctors. But how does this apply to digital interactions, say on social media or virtual consultations?
I think that to a fairly large extent, and we don't always see this actually manifest itself in practice, the same sorts of rules apply to social media interactions as they do to face-to-face interactions. So generally, if you are communicating on social media in your capacity as a doctor, you should be following the general sort of good medical practice guidelines that would apply to face-to-face interactions. So you shouldn't be behaving in a way, for instance, which undermines trust in the medical profession. You shouldn't be breaching confidentiality and sharing patient information on social media. I mean, these sorts of things are fairly obvious, but at the same time, a lot of the discussions that you see between doctors and other doctors and doctors and the general public on social media are probably not the sorts of discussions that you would, or that they're not had in the same way that you would imagine these discussions being had if they were face to face. So what used to be Twitter, now X, is a fairly toxic environment at the best of times, but med Twitter often descends into pretty much name calling and abuse quite readily, which is surprising when sometimes that's with identifiable medical professionals doing that. And occasionally, my understanding is that some of the doctors who have done this have been called in for what I believe are known as meetings without coffee, with senior management within the organizations in which they work, and have been given a telling off. But yeah, generally the same rules apply to social media interactions as they do in normal everyday life in a professional context. You should be respectful. You shouldn't be disclosing things that you have no right to disclose or share. And people do sometimes fall into traps here. So posting photos on social media. So if you're on a placement in a hospital and you happen to take a photo whilst you're in that hospital and you capture the names of patients that are on a board somewhere, then you may potentially unwittingly disclose patient information and land yourself in trouble as a consequence of that. So you have to be really careful about these things.
I do remember a famous incident where the previous Secretary of Health, Jeremy Hunt, took a selfie on a ward with a full board of patient information online and posted it to his many followers.
Yeah, I would generally discourage you from taking photos in a clinical environment and putting them on social media. It's only going to invite problems.
Okay. So now let's talk about ethics in the digital health space. So ethics is at the heart of medical professionalism. And how do you see traditional ethical principles like autonomy and beneficence and justice translating into the digital health space?
So I imagine everybody is familiar with the four principles approach to medical ethics. That's one way of thinking about ethical issues. And it's one way of thinking about issues in relation to digital health data as well. So if we start with everybody's favourite principle, which is respect for autonomy, well, at a fairly sort of simplistic level, people have a right to decide what happens with their lives. That should generally be respected. Obviously, there are some exceptions to that. But part of that involves being able to choose what happens to your personal data and who has access to that, who it's shared with, and for what purposes. So when it comes to like sharing personal information, particularly special category health data, consent is a really important consideration. If you don't have consent to share patient information, you're going to have to find another very, very good reason to share that if it's identifiable personal data. And in a lot of instances, those good reasons simply won't exist. And if you wrongly share information, you may be considered to have harmed a patient, particularly if they find out about it and they are unhappy that their health data has been shared. That's likely to cause a level of psychological distress and may cause breakdown in trust between doctor and patient, things like that, which can have other knock-on harms. I mean, the other important thing to consider, of course, is beneficence, the idea of doing good. And it's important to note that all of this health data can potentially do a huge amount of good. The amount of data that now exists, if that's analysed from a research perspective, could yield some very valuable insights into conditions, pick up patterns and trends in all sorts of things, and lead to a great deal of good to be achieved. But that type of beneficence is always going to run up against the issue of respect for autonomy, where if people don't want their health information to be used for these purposes, then there's a very clear barrier there. If they don't consent to it being used, then maybe you're not going to be able to use it.
Very good. Those are all very, very kind of salient points to talk about that. And actually that links in to our next section. So I wanted to talk about research and data ethics, how you were linking that in with the potential benefits for good and beneficence. So digital health research often involves very large data sets. So what ethical and legal considerations should students be aware of when working with these large sort of patient data sets? What does that make you think about from an ethical stance?
So one of the first considerations for me is what is actually contained in that data set and who has access to it. So if it contains patient identifiable information, it's going to be special category data. So access to that data should be very restricted and typically would be restricted to those who are actually directly involved in the care of the patient. So to use it for other purposes, particularly for research purposes, if it's identifiable information, is likely to require explicit consent from any of those patients. There are some exceptions. So there are some situations where approval can be given for research where patients may not necessarily have consented to their data being used, but that needs to go through a special confidentiality approval group whose name I've now forgotten, but they have to approve anything like that, and there has to be a very clear justification for it. Can you remind me what the question was?
Well, actually, we can join in where you were there. So there are available large NHS data sets that are anonymized, which are being used, such as like the thick database and the thin database, without explicit patient consent. Now, what I want to talk about there and focus was relating to your earlier point about the unintentional de-anonymization by adding in further data. So your example there was somebody who you'd known personally, so you could fill in the gaps yourself. Now, if we look at the use of these large databases like the thick and the thin database, for example, although those are anonymized at the moment, with the increase in computational power and the ability to join in extra data, like you were talking how you personally did it on the spot as you knew other things about that patient, how do you see the ethical principles around that going forward?
Yeah, so I think it depends how rigidly and robustly we define what we mean by anonymization. So if something is truly anonymized, then it should be impossible to ever link that data back to an individual person. But as you say,
of course, what is currently under today's conditions not relatable will potentially become de-anonymized in the future when we can stick in other data sets from other areas.
Yeah, and there may always be possibilities, for instance, that the patient themselves might be able to identify themselves in a data set if there's a particularly unique set of characteristics that they have. I would always argue that if anyone, including the patient themselves, can quite straightforwardly identify themselves in a data set, it's probably not truly anonymized. Maybe that's too demanding a definition of anonymization. But I think you are absolutely right to say that what may seem to be anonymized may actually not be when it's combined with other data, which can potentially then join up dots. And that's a genuine risk that exists with lots of big data sets. And I think the use of AI and big computational models, which can now do amazing things in terms of filling in those blanks and joining dots, that risk of de-anonymization is likely to increase.
Yeah. So, I guess we just have to be careful and be mindful of that going forward. But if you think of any data set that might just look like pure biometric information on your electronic health record, when you combine that with the geographical footprint of where you know the data was collected and that time, and then potentially what medications the patient's on, well, I'm sure in the future that will be very readily unanonymizable data. You'll be able to de-anonymize that.
Yeah, and you only have to look at the ways in which people already exploit our data to know what that could potentially be used for. So if you search for something on Google, you'll suddenly find that all of your adverts on YouTube and social media relate to the things that you've searched about.
Or sometimes even when you just talk about it.
Yeah, that seems to happen. But if you imagine all of your health data being combined with, say, your facial identity, well, if you go into Boots or a pharmacist, suddenly you're potentially going to have things targeted at you on the screens in there. It's so easy to do and very dystopian, but it's exactly the sort of thing that we could imagine happening.
Sounds very profitable.
Very profitable for people, and this is the sad reality of it. These data sets are potentially very profitable for people.
Okay. Now, I want a little practical session here where we talk about any real-world scenarios of us for what our students might be doing. So what would you recommend a student to do if they had accidentally accessed a patient's record that they weren't meant to see? So, for example, they were trying to look up a Joe Bloggs and a patient, and they start and they're searching through the electronic health record database. But actually, there were two Joe Bloggs and they picked up the wrong one. So they've unintentionally opened the wrong patient's record. What should they do?
So I think as a starting point, you own up to it. You don't try to hide the fact that you've done it. You accept that it's a mistake that has been made and you try to respond positively to it. So I think that the first positive step here for a medical student would be to speak to one of the medical team at that practice or wherever this has taken place and to seek some guidance from them and to explore what the local policy is for that type of situation. Technically, that should be considered to be a data breach because someone has accessed data that they should not have accessed. So there will be a local policy in place to respond to that type of thing. If certain thresholds are crossed, then the information commissioner may need to be notified. The patient themselves may need to be informed about these things. But I think importantly, as long as there's no malice involved, this should really be regarded as a learning experience and treated as something to positively learn from rather than a student to be punished for doing, because it's very easy to do these sorts of things and to make these sorts of mistakes. Really, I think it's up to the systems designers to try to minimise the risks of these things happening, but unfortunately they will sometimes happen.
Yeah, very much so. So really the short and skinny on that one is consult a senior and own up, and then you'll be advised about what to do.
Yeah, I mean, consulting a senior is the cop-out answer that I try to discourage people from giving to any sort of challenging situation, but actually here that there will be a local policy which will advise you on exactly what you should do in this situation, and that senior will have access to that.
Brilliant. So, second scenario. A student is on their WhatsApp or any social media platform, and they see that one of their colleagues, a friend, is sharing some patient information in a group chat. Now, I'm not talking about their address and their bank details here, but just some information, like we talked about before, that's potentially de-anonymizable, you know, a condition, some of the presenting symptoms, for example. What is the right thing for that student to do as a bystander in that situation?
So I would encourage a student in that situation to not ignore this. I would suggest to send a message to your colleague, encouraging them to think about the information that they are sharing, advising them that actually this is potentially identifiable information and that they should potentially consider deleting it immediately. I think the next step there, and I appreciate that this can be difficult to do, but it would be the right thing to do, would probably be to submit a low-level professionalism concern to the medical school so that we can ensure that that student is then advised in relation to sharing patient identifiable information. Because I don't think anyone does these things on purpose, but some people just need some additional clarity and clarification on some of the pitfalls here. So I think it might identify a sort of training opportunity.
Very good. Okay, so we're beginning the wrap up now. So just final thoughts before we wrap up. So what are the three things that you'd want every medical student to remember when it comes to professionalism and ethics in digital health?
So the first thing that I think everyone should consider, particularly medical students, is that data protection should be taken seriously. So I think people tend to switch off whenever they hear the letters GDPR or the words Data Protection Act, because you immediately think about mandatory training that all of us have had to complete at some point, which tends to be low quality, seems like box ticking, and you just click through it and hope that you make it to the end successfully. But there is a lot more to data protection than that. This is really about protecting people's privacy, protecting people's right to determine what they do with their lives. A failure to protect data undermines these sorts of things. And it's really problematic, particularly for the medical profession, where you will be trusted by patients. Patients need to be able to share often their most sort of personal and intimate information with you. If you fail to do that, if you fail to protect that data appropriately, well, once it's in the public domain or once it's been shared with other people, it's very difficult to make that situation right. Once there has been a data breach and data is out there, it's very difficult to get it back again and to be confident that no one still has access to it. So you really do, in some respects, only have one chance to get this right. So you should take it seriously at all times, which I think leads me on to my second point, which is that I don't think that people tend to breach confidentiality deliberately. Most times it happens in a fairly casual and unintentional way. So because I'm interested in these sorts of things, whenever I'm in a hospital, I do tend to keep an eye out for breaches of patient confidentiality.
Okay, kind of, and where data protection has... voyeurism.
Yeah, so situations where it has not been taken seriously. So examples that I can give where I've been at various clinics where a doctor will have walked into a waiting room, called a patient's name, and the patient notes they'll be holding the patient's paper notes under their arms, and things on those notes will be very clearly visible to someone who's trying to read them. Well, they've just breached patient confidentiality in that situation, where I've been able to read things about patients that I should not have been able to read. It's so easy to do, but it's a problem. You think about the types of conversations that, that doctors might have in corridors. If someone happens to be listening to those conversations, then again, they may learn things about patients that they shouldn't. And these are fairly minor breaches in the grand scheme of things.
And certainly sound unintentional.
Unintentional, but nonetheless, they happen and they shouldn't be happening. So I remember when my wife was pregnant, we were at some of the clinics involved with that. You see all of these piles of the green notes left unattended on the front desk. Yeah. Whilst the receptionist had walked away.
A pile of data for anyone.
Yeah, anyone could access that data. And actually, that data potentially contains really sensitive information, both about the pregnancy, but also women who are experiencing domestic abuse can flag in that documentation that they are being exposed to these things. So there is genuine risk here about really sensitive data being exposed to other people. And it's just through casualness, really, not taking it seriously enough. A real problem that is. And I think my third point would be that any data about patients can potentially be accessed by patients. So when you are making notes about patients, you should make those notes with the idea that the patient may potentially be reading those at some point. So if even though you may make really sort of acerbic judgments about patients that you have in front of you, they should obviously not be written down in patient notes. And maybe you shouldn't be making those sorts of judgments in the first place, but we're all human. But you certainly shouldn't be documenting anything like that. You should make sure that your data is clear, factual, and non-judgmental.
Oh, very much so. And in general practice, our computers remind us this will be read by your patient, and it appears on their phones now, straight away, so they can read it. And as soon as we've saved that consultation, it definitely makes us all very much more conscious of making clear notes, certainly, if we say that. Okay, well, I think we've covered a lot of data there. If our audience want to learn any more about this very interesting and very important area, in the transcript of the episode, which is available on our website, I've put in links to the British Medical Association's guidance on personal ethics and social media, and British Medical Association principles for artificial intelligence, AI, and its application in healthcare as well. So I'd just like to take this opportunity to thank you so much, Greg, for coming and joining us all on this podcast today. I hope you've had a nice time, and maybe we'll see you back soon.
Yep, thanks for having me.